This is the Encevides Podcast. I'm Nick Savides, your host. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Our guest today is Steve Kaplan. He is a comedy expert who has given presentations about comedy across the world. He's worked with companies like HBO, DreamWorks, Disney, Paramount as a comedy consultant. He developed the HBO Workspace and the HBO New Writers Program. His theater company in New York, Punchline Theater, has developed all kinds of people, including Peter Tolan from Analyze This and The Larry Sanders Show, David Crane, the co-creator of Friends, Michael Patrick, king of Sex and the City, to say nothing of the actors Steve has helped develop throughout the years as well, including Nathan Lane, John Leguizamo, and Bob Odenkirk. Steve also has a book on comedy called The Hidden Tools of Comedy, and it presents a systematic approach that people can use to get better at comedy, whether in films, TV shows, or just in day-to-day interactions. We could all use a little bit of comedy in our lives, especially in these dark and complicated times. So we talk about that and about Steve's upcoming workshops across the world. You might have a chance to see him. He might be coming near you. All that and more coming up next in our interview with Steve Kaplan. Stick around.
This is the Encevides Podcast. Hello, hello, hello.
Steve Kaplan, welcome to the Encevides Podcast.
Good to be here.
You have quite a distinguished background. So by way of introduction, tell us a little bit about that and how you got into comedy.
Well, I got into comedy the way a lot of people got into comedy. We were being chased after school, and so we either had to learn to run pretty fast or learn to be funny to kind of disarm our attackers. And so at the time, I did both. I was pretty fast, and I tried to learn how to make people laugh as a way of getting attention, as a way of getting love. As Ray Romano said, if I had been hugged once as a kid, I would have become an accountant.
Yeah.
So
you're also a marathon runner then, can we assume? Not quite.
I would think. I don't know. When I was growing up, I was fascinated by people who made people laugh. I remember that I was once at a dance, and they said, "Do we have any requests?" And I actually said, "Could you play 'Thanks for the Memory'?" Because Bob Hope was one of my heroes.
Sure. Yeah, you're a big Bob Hope guy, right?
I was a big Bob Hope guy, Woody Allen. I mean, I was kind of fascinated by them, and I didn't quite have the ability to do stand up myself. The joke is, I tried to do stand up once, and I was asked never to come back, not even as a customer. But I was fascinated by it, and when I had a chance to, after college, I started directing. I worked in various small theaters in New York, and when I had an opportunity to start a small theater, the idea struck me that I wanted to start a theater that was completely devoted to comedy. And this was a time in New York when there wasn't a lot of comedy in New York in terms of serious theater. Serious theater was basically people wearing black turtlenecks and doing chamber productions of The Three Sisters. But I wanted to do a theater that was completely devoted to comedy. And we did. We did original plays. We presented stand-up nights. We had an improv group. And a lot of great people came out of this theater, Manhattan Punchline, in New York. And some of the playwrights were David Crane, who went on to do Friends, Peter Tolan, who went on to do Analyze That and Rescue Me. Some of the actors were Oliver Platt, Nathan Lane, who went on to some small success on Broadway. So we a lot of great people came out of this, and we were doing plays. Improv groups were run by Michael Patrick King, who went on to do Sex and the City and Two Broke Girls. And while I was doing this, in the beginning, I thought I knew everything there was to know about comedy. But after doing it for a couple of years, I thought to myself, okay, I don't know everything there is to know about comedy, but I know it's not funny.
Let's go back to your theater company, the Manhattan Punchline. And I'm just so intrigued that you founded it in response to the excess of black turtlenecks and humorless angst. So two things. First of all, as someone who was born in New York, I consider myself a New Yorker. So as a New Yorker, thank you. And then secondly,
what the hell are you doing in Baton Rouge?
Well, that's a long story.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that on another podcast.
Yeah, some other day on the Shakespeare Live production. We have you reciting Shakespearean monologues. We'll do that intro.
Okay.
Secondly, on that note, I was wondering if you would be interested in participating in my production of an angsty black turtleneck show involving testicular cancer. I think it could be great.
It's actually funny you should mention that. I've actually worked with a couple of people on their one-person cancer shows.
Uh-huh. So you're like, yeah, I got to get out of this.
No. I'm happy. I'm happy to help. My friend Sheila Head's show. I suggested the title. No one wants to hear about your ex. You know, blankety
right.
blank
testicular
cancer.
Cancer or breast cancer or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I would actually not want to do that show.
Okay.
So just kidding.
It's happening. It's been done.
Yeah. For the kids listening, that's an example of a joke that doesn't work because clearly I'm not the professional here. But there is a lot of that. I think we've all sat through those kind of shows. What does intrigue me, though, is that you had so many great people, like you said, come out of that. And I am fascinated by these creative hubs like your theater company or the Actor's Studio, where so many great people come out of them. So I was wondering, what are some of the secrets for that kind of communal success?
Well, I think it really comes down to quantity. It's hard to excel as a genius in isolation. It's hard to be the most brilliant guy in Butte, Montana, if there's nobody else to bounce off of. Now I know for a fact that there are brilliant people in Butte, Montana, but the fact is that the confluence of opportunity and collaboration exists where there's a lot of people. So that doesn't mean that everybody who gathers together in a group is going to be great. But if I'm working with 12 other people and I'm the funniest or the best writer there, I need to find another group. I need to find a group where somebody is going to be teaching me, where I can borrow from somebody else, where I can learn from somebody else, where I can steal from somebody else, because that's the way that great creativity happens. They happen in clusters where people push each other, people challenge each other, people innovate, and then I go, wow, okay, that's a great idea. How about if I do this? So I think yes, it's important that you have the opportunity and the structure. But I also think it just comes down to there's millions of people in New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Chicago. And some of those people are not going to work out and some of those people are not going to be successful. But if you get enough of them together, all wanting to do the same thing, and with a few people who can give you a structure in which you can flourish, then you can have Second City. You can have Dudley Riggs' Brave New Workshop in Minneapolis. Then you can have The Connection. I think that was the group in San Francisco. Then you can have Groundlings in Los Angeles. Not because the people starting them were so brilliant or visionary, but simply because they gave people an opportunity to come together. When people say, how can I get started in the business? I always say, you don't necessarily have to come to New York or Los Angeles, but go somewhere where there are other people and a lot of other people doing what you want to do and get into that group and learn from them and steal like crazy, and then find your own voice and make it your own.
Okay. One more question about that group. Another one of the distinguished alumni was Kenneth Lonergan, right?
Yeah, Ken Lonergan. Ken Lonergan was actually a student in a playwriting class of mine at NYU. And then he and a number of his fellow alumni did a show called Woofer the Psychic Dog that we presented at one of our late night shows. That's a really good example of, you had 12 playwrights in this playwriting program at NYU, and they all kind of worked together, and they did this little sketch show, really silly, about a psychic dog, but it helped spur their own creativity and their own growth. So I just saw Manchester by the Sea, which is, by the way, not very funny.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a little different. Did you see it and think like, okay, good stuff, great performances, but come on, Kenny, Kalo, can you throw in one prattleful for us? Come on, just for the old days, right?
Lighten up, Kenny. Yeah. No, he's a brilliant observer of the human condition, which sometimes is not funny because there are tragedies that occur. I mean, and basically that's the difference between comedy and tragedy. Comedy is the art of hope. And when hope is absent, it becomes drama or tragedy. So his story about this guy struggling with the death of his children, there's nothing funny about that. I mean, and to try to make it funny, I guess you could.
Unless there was a good prattlefall, right? A little pie in the face.
Well, maybe, but I think if you look at what makes a comedy work, a comedy works because hope is present. Now, it might be futile hope or stupid hope, but there's hope. Some idiot thinks that he's going to win the day or get the girl or do something that he hasn't done before, and he could be wrong about it, but there's still hope. I mean, even in something as silly as Dumb and Dumber, those guys have hope, even though, you know, they're completely clueless.
Yeah, that was a nice segue. You segued ahead of me, so nicely done, sir. But yeah,
you're welcome.
I just wanted to throw in that bit about Kenneth Lonergan. No disrespect, I've admired his work since You Can Count on Me. It was just, I remember reading it and doing a double take, like, he was a comedy guy, and like, all right, he has written some comedy stuff as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, you shared your definition. In your book, you say, comedy is about an ordinary guy or gal struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. So I was wondering if you could expand on that. Why is comedy that and not something else?
Well, let me first say that there's a difference between comedy and humor. I'm talking about performance comedy, whether it's in a sketch show or a play or a movie or a TV sitcom. That comedy concerns somebody who is less than, struggling to do something that they cannot do and yet never giving up. So that out of that paradigm comes all these usable practical tools that we wrote about in The Hidden Tools of Comedy. And note that I use the royal we so as to not be, you know, bragging on myself.
Right. I mean, some of those ideas maybe came from Kenneth Lonergan, let's say.
Okay. I stole from everybody. So there's the idea that in comedy gives you the permission to win. That doesn't mean you're going to win, but it does mean that you have the permission to do what you think you need to do in order to win. In Annie Hall, it's Woody Allen winning an argument with a guy while online at the New Yorker movie theater by grabbing Marshall McLuhan out from behind a poster to win his argument. Now, that could probably never happen, but comedy gives you the permission to do what you need to do in order to win. Comedy is about a non-hero, a guy who isn't a clown, isn't an exaggerated buffoon, but simply somebody who lacks some, if not the all the essential skills and tools with which to win. Comedy, one of the tools of comedy is metaphorical relationship, that beneath the surface relationship, there is a true metaphorical relationship, which, in The Odd Couple, Oscar and Felix are roommates. That's their surface relationship. But the way the comedy works is that Felix treats Oscar as though Oscar's the husband and Felix is the wife. And so even though he's not aware of that, that we in the audience are aware of that metaphor, and metaphorical relationship is also about the perception, about how people perceive the world, what we call worldview, that different characters behave not because they're trying to do something funny, but because they see the world in a particular way. In The Big Bang Theory, if you put a beautiful girl in the room, Wolowitz all of a sudden sees her and she looks like a lamb chop and he's a wolf. This is before, of course, he was married. Whereas Sheldon thinks that she's just a problem to be analyzed and solved. So that how you see the world, the perception of the world, is at the heart of the comedy, as opposed to somebody, some silly person doing some silly thing. And that brings us to another tool, which we call straight line, wavy line, which is the idea that comedy isn't watching somebody do something silly. John Cleese, when they started Monty Python, said that when they started Monty Python, they thought that comedy was watching somebody do something silly. They came to realize that comedy is watching somebody watch somebody do something silly, that in many situations, not in all situations, but in many situations, there's the person who is on a straight line, like they have blinders on. They're either creating the problem or blind to the problem, whereas the other character is a wavy line. They're struggling with the problem, but because they're a non-hero, they can't solve it. So you'll see straight line, wavy line a lot in sitcoms like Seinfeld, where Kramer says something crazy and Jerry just looks at him. And the comedy doesn't come just because Kramer's a funny guy who says something silly. The comedy is actually teamwork. We go back to that whole idea of collaboration. The comedy is teamwork because it's not just the silly guy doing something silly. It's also the guy who's most represents us, who's kind of in at that moment, in that scene, who's kind of our stand-in, our representative on stage and screen, who kind of looks at Kramer and doesn't know what to do with him. He's befuddled. He's confused.
Right. And I'll tell you that notion you have, the straight line, squiggly line, was one of the more helpful concepts to me in going through your book. And we'll come back to it here in a moment, but I want to expand a little bit on your notion about comedy being an inherently hopeful genre. Let's say, for example, someone is just berating someone with a series of mean-spirited jokes. Would you say, okay, that's not really comedy then? This person is doing something else. He's insulting, he's using his wit, but that's not quite comedy.
That situation reminds me of the scene in Silicon Valley where T.J. Miller is going to give his 2 cents to Stephen Tobolowsky, who the head of the financial group, the people who are financing the app that they're going to bring public. They want to make him the president of the company. And so T.J. Miller goes in there, and T.J. Miller is this fantastic improviser, and he improvises like 10 minutes of just terrible insults. But the reason that you find it funny and that you don't just feel abused by it is because, one, Stephen Tobolowsky is just kind of looking at T.J. Miller as though he's just this odd little animal that he's not at all bothered by. And T.J. Miller is painting the portrait of his own character. So that's an important concept in terms of performing comedy. If you in a drama, if I am angry at you and I'm yelling at you and blaming you for stuff, as an actor, I'm saying you're wrong and I'm right. And I'm asking the audience to empathize with me and sympathize with me and side with me against you. But in a comedy, the actor might be saying you're wrong and I'm right, but at the same time, the actor or actress is allowing us to see how stupid and infantile and misbegotten our character is, how we are wrong. So it's important in a comedy, and this is one of the tools of positive action, that everything your character is doing, your character thinks it's actually going to work. But while you're using a positive action, you are allowing your character to reveal itself to the audience, as opposed to protecting or whitewashing your character to make your character the hero in the scene and the other person the villain in the scene. It's why George can be angry at somebody, but it stays in a comic mode because Jason Alexander is letting us see what a jerk and an idiot George is.
Right, George in Seinfeld.
In Seinfeld, right. Whenever I say the word George, I'm always referencing Seinfeld.
Okay, fair enough. So this ties in a little bit to your theory of how comedy and drama are different, how comedy is about the ordinary person or people as they are to an extent, and drama is who we aspire to be. So this brings up the notion or the possibility of what to do with the comic who becomes heroic. And so the classic example of that is Henry V, right? And it's almost like with that, you see Shakespeare, not only does he make Henry more serious, more inspiring, but he makes him cut ties with Falstaff. So he's no longer...
Brutally, ruthless.
So do you feel like that is something that other storytellers have to think about? It's like, hey, if you have your character who starts off comedic and you're telling this epic story and he matures into someone who is an inspiring heroic figure, then you have to somehow distance him from the comedy, or can you still have the...
Yeah, you do that in order to have a romantic comedy or a comedy thriller or a comedy action piece, because what you're going to do is when you want the comedy to be there, your characters have to be flawed. But when you want the romance to be there or the action to be there or the drama to be there, your characters have to then become heroic. That's why we call it non-hero. A non-hero isn't an idiot. He's simply somebody who lacks some, if not all, the essential tools. So in Groundhog Day, for instance, Bill Murray starts off as a jerk. He's a selfish, cynical jerk. But in the middle of the film, as he's falling in love with Rita, and played by Andy McDowell, and he doesn't know it, but we in the audience know it, he all of a sudden he becomes sensitive, caring, observant, romantic. So when you think about these characteristics, you can think about increasing and decreasing the amount of comedy in your scene as though you're potting up and down on a soundboard. You increase the skills the character has, becomes a more dramatic scene. You decrease the skills the character has, becomes a more comedic scene.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting way to think about it. And then like, do you dial down all the comedy, or you just maybe give it to the supporting actor?
You dial down the character. If the character is acting, if you give the character skills, the scene is going to be less comic, unless you have another comic character in the scene. But if you increase the comic attributes of the character, it's a more comic scene. So it's not the scene, it's the character. Comedy is actor-centric. It's character-centric. And the best comedies come from character. Explore character, develop character, and come from character, as opposed to plot and incident. If you look at most bad comedies, it's because they're throwing plot and incident on top of each other, one after the other. Whereas if you think of the best comedies, and one of the other another tool in the book is comic premise, which is the idea that you get to lie, you get to tell a big whopping lie once in your feature. But after that, you have to develop the scenario honestly and organically based on character and theme.
Can you give an example of when that doesn't happen?
Okay. There's an animated film called Chicken Little. And in Chicken Little, an anthropomorphic chicken wrongly alerts his town that the sky is falling, creating great humiliation and shame for him and his father.
Okay. And that's the comic premise, right?
Well, yeah. At a time in which humiliation is worse than death, he's in middle school. Now, that in and of itself could be developed. And in the middle of that, there's an alien invasion.
Ah.
Those are two separate movies.
Right. That feels like a bit of a cheat then, bringing in the aliens midway through or something.
One would have been enough. The aliens, yeah, they kind of justify it, but it's a different movie. And it doesn't help us develop the character, develop the theme. Another example is in an obscure Chris Rock movie called Head of State. In Head of State, Chris Rock plays an alderman in Washington, D.C., probably the least powerful elected official in the United States. And because of an accident that occurs that kills the presidential and vice presidential candidates for a political party, the evil head of the party puts Chris Rock up so that he can lose in order so the evil head of the party can run himself 4 years later. So that's the setup. So it's a kind of a political romantic comedy, a political satire. So in the middle of the movie, there's this sequence where they're at a fundraiser, and it's very staid and bored and boring. And the girl from the hood who Chris Rock wants to get with is there. And so in the middle of this boring fundraiser, he starts dancing with her and they start doing this kind of hip hop dance. And then she's kind of catering the party. She's just a serving girl. So she goes off. She says, I have to go back to work. And then rather than going after her, because that's what I would do if the girl of my dreams was there and she walks away, I'd want to walk after her and maybe say, can we meet later? Or did I do something to upset you or something? What he does is he goes, kicks the DJ off the record player, starts playing hip hop music, and all the white people who up heretofore didn't know any of these dances or any of these music, all the white people start dancing. So now you have this big musical scene in which all the old rich white people are doing these hip hop dances that obviously they never knew before. And then as Chris Rock is playing the DJ, he says, the roof is on fire. And then a woman screams. You see a close-up of a big fat woman go, ah! And everybody screams and panics and runs out.
So once again, two implausible things that they're jamming into.
Right. I mean, it's implausible that, you know, and this is, by the way, you know, 10, 15 years before Barack Obama, the first implausible thing, oh yeah, a black man running for president. So that was their premise. But then they thought, wouldn't it be funny if we put in this silly dance sequence? That would be funny too. So my thought is, and somebody out there in your podcast universe could probably find an example where a film did it and it worked. And I acknowledge that because, you know, exceptions prove the rule. But as a general thought, you don't need to gild the lily. You don't need to comic the comic. If you have a great situation, just develop it. See what happens. If you think of the movie Big, a young boy, the premise is a young boy wakes up and he's a 30-year-old man. He wishes he were bigger on a fortune-telling machine. He wakes up. He's now a 30-year-old man. So are there any other lies in that movie?
It seems pretty character-driven from that point on.
Now, somebody might say, yeah, but how about the time in which he dances on the keyboard at FAO Schwartz? Isn't that a lie? And if you look at it, he's living in a flop house that his friend stole money to put him up, because he's waiting to find the fortune telling machine to go back to being a 12-year-old. He's got to be somewhere. He can't go to school. They'll think he's a child molester. So where would a kid hang out? He would hang out in a toy store. So he's hanging out at FAO Schwartz. And yeah, but why does he dance on the keyboard with the head of a toy company? Well, now that's where theme comes into play, because why doesn't he meet a guy who runs a gas station? Because that has nothing to do with the theme of the movie. The theme of the movie is what's the nexus between adulthood and childhood? So if that's your theme, the theme is going to call on character choices. Why have one of your big characters run a gas station? What has that got to do with the nexus, the intersection between childhood and adulthood? Where is that intersection most famously found? In a toy company, a company that's run by adults for children. So a guy who runs a toy company would be an FAO Schwartz, and that's how he finds him. And originally, he just gives him a job, like a low-level job, in his computer department, because he asks Tom Hanks, what do you know? And he says, I know computers, because he played a lot of computer games as a 12-year-old. So you can see that even that meeting develops out of character or theme, as opposed to wouldn't it be funny if. Groundhog Day is another example. Who are the characters in Groundhog Day? You have Bill Murray, your tricky, clever servant. You have Andy McDowell, who's your object of desire, because love is a magical power in and of itself. You know, it's not just the magic of him living the same day over and over again in Groundhog Day. It's also the magic that love can transform you. Most psychiatrists will tell you if you're a jerk, you marry a jerk, 30 years later, you're going to have a older, fatter, balder jerk. But in romantic comedy, love is transformative. It transforms people. And then you have the cameraman. And why is he there? He's there because of need. Characters are brought on to scenarios through theme or need. Without a cameraman, you're going to have a terrible shoot on the remote. So you need a cameraman. The fact that they made him a comic character is a plus, but whether he was a comic character or not, you need the remote crew. You need the producer, the cameraman, and the talent. Who's the only other character in Groundhog Day? There's really only one other character in Groundhog Day. His mother's not in Groundhog Day, because Groundhog Day is not about family. The president of the United States is not in Groundhog Day, because Groundhog Day is not about politics. The only other character in Groundhog Day is the town, because the theme of Groundhog Day is how can you be a mensch in the world? And mensch is a Yiddish word that means mensch, or a man, or a good person. How can you be a good person in the world? So you need the world. So the only other character is that town, the people in that town. In one of the drafts of Groundhog Day, they did do silly stuff after the evening of the second day in the script. And you can Google Groundhog Day. What will come up on the internet is the second draft written by Harold Ramis and Danny Rubin. And in that draft on day two, at the night, he's already lived the day once, and he wants to know if it's really happening. So in the draft, he shaves his hair into a mohawk. He trashes the room. He sets fire to the room. He paints the walls all different colors. He destroys the room like he's a rock star. And they shot that. They shot that scene. And when they looked at it, in the dailies or whatever, they said to themselves, why would he do that? Why would this cynical, selfish guy do that? It made no sense to them. It was there just because it would be, wouldn't it be funny, quote unquote. You always want to avoid, wouldn't it be funny? And so what they did at great expense was they dumped that scene and they reshot it. And if you watch the movie, what he does is he takes a pencil and he breaks it in half, puts one end on the floor and one half on the night table. And when 6 o'clock rolls around and you hear Sonny and Cher, "I Got You, Babe," he looks for the pencil and he picks it off the floor and the pencil is whole. And that's how he knows for sure this is happening. So that's an example of developing a narrative, not based on wouldn't it be funny if, based on let's put in this gag and that gag, but based on who are the characters, what's the theme, what do the characters want, what are they willing to do to get what they want, and what would happen then.
All right, and one comic premise, he lives the day over and over and over again, and then everything else is character-driven from that.
Everything else develops from the characters, and the characters are brought on either by need, because you need that kind of character there. If I'm sitting at a table with a girl in a restaurant, I need a waiter to come by to take our order. That character is brought on through need. But if the theme is friendship, an old friend of mine might come in and ruin my date.
That makes sense.
I want to take a quick break from our interview with Steve Kaplan to tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this show. I also do various freelance film and video projects, including directing the occasional short film or whatnot. And speaking of ruining the date, I once made a short film about that called Up to Date. It won a couple of awards in the festival circuit. So I'll include it in the show notes if you want to take a look. Why not, right? I'd appreciate it. I'm working on a couple of other projects as well that might involve comedy. If people laugh, we're not sure. If they don't, forget I said that. Anyway, if you connect, if you want to work together with me on something, let me know. The email for that is podcast@ncivitis.com. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Steve Kaplan.
You talked a little bit about this before, so let's go back to a bit about how comedy is about teamwork. And in your book, you give an example of how that's not always the case in actuality, how on some shows, for example, a star might say, well, I'm going to take all the lines where people laugh and I want them to come to me. Why is that less than ideal? Why does that hurt the overall comedy as a whole?
Because as great comic performers like Bill Murray, like Ray Romano, they realize that comedy isn't just doing something funny or saying something funny. Comedy is being the wavy line in the scene, being the person who sees it but doesn't quite know what to do. So if you look at an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond, what you'll notice is he's surrounded by wonderfully funny people. And that's what makes that show work so well, as opposed to him needing to be at the center of every joke, having the laugh on every line. I had a friend who was on a show that was headlined by a famously tempestuous and difficult star. I'm not going to name any names, Grace Butler. And at that show, I sometimes would go to tapings as a support. And what you could see happen is that there was a table read. And at the table read, talented professional comedy writers had written a talented professional comedy script in which different characters said different things. And the character of Grace in Grace Under Fire did not say every line. But by Wednesday or Thursday, she had every punchline. So when you watch the taping, nothing made sense because she was answering herself half the time. There were no setups. There is no character development. There's no narrative. It was just a series of her saying weirdly idiosyncratic and non sequitur type things, because those were all the funny lines that had been there on Monday. Made no sense. It was horrific to watch, but it still happens every day that somebody has a funny line, and by Wednesday or Thursday, that the day player who had the line, or the guy who's the guest star who's on for the week, no longer has that line. On some shows where people don't realize that comedy is about the team, the scenario, the comedic troupe that's performing that scenario, as opposed to I'm the funny guy, I'm going to do the funny thing.
Right. And like you say, sometimes it's the person reacting to the amusing line that's funnier than the right. amusing line itself.
A good example of that is Chris Rock. I mean, in early Chris Rock movies, Chris Rock would do all the funny stuff. For instance, in the movie I talked about, Head of State, he not only has the romantic comedy narrative through line going, he wants the girl, but he's the one who slaps the uptight black guy, you know, to get him to be more hip, more funk. Then he's the one doing the DJ. He's doing everything. And as opposed to giving some of the comedy stuff to some supporting characters. Whereas in his latest movie, Top Five, he didn't do everything. In fact, I can't remember the actor's name, but he's a famous African-American stand-up. And he has that guy do all the crazy stuff while Chris Rock just kind of cowers in a corner looking confused and befuddled. So as he talked about and working at the film, he says what he learned from Louis C.K. is that all you got to do is set up an impossible situation, then say, well, what would the guy do then? What would the guy really do after that? What would happen then?
Yeah, and it sounds like it's a sign of maturity for the comedic performer to be able to say, hey, we're better as an ensemble if the spotlight isn't always on me, if the laughs are distributed.
Right, because sometimes you got to be the one to carry the narrative thread of the romance or the thriller.
Going back to your notion of the straight line, wavy line, that was quite informative to me because you present it in contrast to the straight man, funny man that people sometimes talk about in comedy. And so with your explanation, it's more fluid that someone could be essentially the straight man in one part of the scene and then switch to the comedic guy in another part.
Exactly. By George, I think you've got it.
Give an example where you'd walk us through that and how it can change.
There's a scene from Seinfeld in which George has stopped having sex because he's dating somebody who has mono, and he becomes a genius. He answers all the questions on Jeopardy almost before they even ask them. He figures out how to do a Rubik's Cube in record time. And all Jerry does is look at it and go, is this a repeat? And then when Jerry figures it out, it's because you're not having sex. The focus switches to George. George is now in focus. The person who's struggling with the problem is the one who's in focus. And now Jerry goes off on this thing about how, you know, he takes a big iceberg lettuce and he tears off a little piece of it. He says, now this is your brain, and he takes this little piece. This is the part of the brain obsessed with sex. That's the huge lettuce. And this is the part that's your intelligence. And then he says, now you have done an awful lot with this little amount. And all we see George do is kind of go, well, kind of shrug his shoulders and go, well, it wasn't like, you know, very proud that he got the world's worst compliment. But what we see is that when Jerry's confused, Jerry's in focus. Then when Jerry's figured it out, the dynamic switches, the focus switches, and then Jerry becomes the straight line because he's not the one struggling. And George becomes the wavy line because he's going, really? What? He's trying to figure it out. So that dynamic can switch back and forth several times in a scene, line to line, moment to moment.
Yeah, and it's usually the guy that's the wavy line that would be more amusing because it's
Again, that's the problem. It's not more amusing. The team is amusing.
Right.
The situation that they create is amusing. Not one of the you like we always say, you can't have Mork without Mindy.
Okay, good point.
You need some human being in the scenario, and the situation becomes amusing, not just the one person.
Okay. Well, it's been great hearing you elaborate a little bit on some of your principles. If you have the time, let's flesh them out on some projects. You talked a little bit about Groundhog's Day, a classic film. So if you want, you can elaborate a little bit more on how some of the principles apply there, but then maybe we can also talk about how they might apply to a contemporary show like Silicon Valley that you touched on briefly, and then we'll close it out with Inside Out.
Well, one of the tools that we talk about is archetypes. So in Groundhog Day, you see the value of a comic premise. They have a great comic premise.
Yeah,
comic
very, premise. Very strong, easy to understand.
Something that's impossible or implausible that could never happen or probably never happen. But if it does happen, it begs the question, what would happen then? And so you see that's then developed through the movie. In Silicon Valley, you see the power of archetype. Archetype is the idea that comic characters are archetypes of human behavior. And we go back to not only, ancient Greek time, but even more recently, but still hundreds of years ago. There was this theater form called Commedia dell'arte, in which, because nobody was literate at the time, there were no playwrights, basically characters took on the archetypical characters from ancient times, clever, tricky servants, lecherous old men, dim young lovers. And they use those archetypical characters to power scenes. All they would have is basically a premise, entrances and exits, and everything else was improvised because there were no playwrights and nobody was writing it down. So here you had a theater form in which the character stayed the same, but the situations would change with each scenario. Can you think of an art form in which, I don't know, characters stay the same, but maybe situations change, say maybe, like on a weekly basis?
Yeah, like a sitcom.
Like a sitcom. So one of the things that's so great about Silicon Valley is you have these clearly defined characters. And one of the strengths of that is that you put these clearly defined characters in any situation and you can almost anticipate what might happen, but then you might be surprised by what else happens because the characters are not stereotypical. In other words, they're not frozen in time. The thought that in sitcoms nobody evolves is incorrect. They just evolve very slowly. So you have T.J. Miller, who's the consummate shit artist. And you have the two engineers, one of whom is very dark and cynical. And the other one of whom is kind of very dweeby and insecure. And between the two of them, you have between those two engineers, you then have Thomas Middleditch, I think that's his name, who plays the inventor who is a bundle of nerves and yet also a bundle of ambition. So basically, you have this great comedy troupe acting out all these scenarios.
Yeah. All right. That makes sense. And then for something like Pixar's Inside Out, very sophisticated animation, but a lot of it's dealing with comedy. How do you figure the comedy works in a film like that?
The comedy works by allowing us to care and empathize with the characters involved. The other the other misconception about comedy is that tragedy are for those who feel, and comedy is for those who think. Now, there's some, that's an old saying, and there might be some truth to that.
Really? I miss that saying. So people would say comedy is for the thinking man, right?
Yeah.
Like the old pie in the face. Let me think about that and see. Ah, yes, that's very funny.
Well, you know, the thought being that why would you laugh at somebody who's being attacked? That must mean that you have an absence of feeling. So this is very 19th century conception of comedy. So that comedy is about absenting, distancing yourself from the emotions.
Okay.
But I disagree with that, because comedy is about attaching yourself to the emotions of the characters in the scenes without necessarily whitewashing them or forgiving them their flaws. So in Inside Out, you see how desperate Joy is to control the little girl's feelings. And when sadness, you know, kind of bumbles into one of her core feelings and turns it into sadness, all hell breaks loose. And what happens is that both sadness and Joy get sucked up into the tube that brings all the core memories to long-term memory. And then they have to try to get back to headquarters. So while that's happening, we're brought back to think about things that are really important to us, our own childhoods, our own way of thinking and dealing with it. And one of the brilliant things about Inside Out is having come up with the idea that inside of all of us are these different emotions, different personalities that are controlling us. Now, that would have been enough, but what was genius about it was they explored what would that be like in the parents. And so that's some of the funniest sequences in which they're, you know, the mom and the dad are about to have a very important talk with the kid, and the control room inside mom is saying, alert the husband, alert the husband. And you see all the guys, you know, because they all have mustaches, they're all sitting around watching sports or thinking about sports. And then they look on the screen and there's the eyes of the wife, and they're going, "What? Oh my God, what's up? Are we in trouble?" And having been married for a long time, I really empathize with that. One of the things that's brilliant about Inside Out is how it marries the impossible. There aren't little people inside our heads, but if there were,
are you sure about that, Steve? Can we quote you?
I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong, but I'm reasonably sure. It marries those people in our heads with a real theme, which is, what do we do with the sadness in our life? And in the beginning, Joy is all about getting rid of sadness. And what's brilliant about the film, what really moves you about the film, is how true the film is, where you say you have to accept that stuff, accept the sadness in your life in order to move on, in order to grow as a human being. So Inside Out also shows one of the strengths about comedy. Comedy tells the truth. And specifically, comedy tells the truth about people. It's not just being silly and what's exaggerated and pies in the face and fart jokes. Although, listen, I'm not one to put down fart jokes, but comedy is able to tell us the truth about who we are and how we live our lives in a way that, you know, that drama, that Manchester at the Sea sometimes can't.
Right.
You know,
way to bring that back in there. Come on, he could have done one Pride Will Fall, one pie. All right,
one pie. Thanks. I mean, listen, Manchester at the Sea is a brilliant movie, but, and I'm not taking anything away from that, but there's a reason why comedies are never included as given the awards as the best films because people don't think they're important enough. And I think that comedies are the most important. They tell the truth about who we really are and how we really act. And in a great comedy, you'll have both tragedy and despair as well as comedy, whereas in many dramas, you don't have that comedic edge. So I think comedies are
notably missing Kenneth Lonergan, if you can hear us.
But no, I love Ken Lonergan.
No, it's great. A very talented guy. But
just because Manchester in the Sea is powerful doesn't mean that a comedy can't be equally as important.
Right. So would you consider Inside Out a great comedy because it does have some of those things you discussed?
I think that Pixar, with maybe the exception of Cars 2, Pixar doesn't just make great animated movies or great animated comedies. They make great movies. Great movies that stand up to the test of time and are funny and moving. And you can't ask more of a comedy.
And I wanted to touch on one more thing about Inside Out. In thinking about it, preparing for this interview, it's striking. A lot of the comedy they get actually, ironically enough, comes from sadness, right? She's the one that's falling around, knocking things down, like, oh, come on. So it's great that they have that character who is poignant. And then we are reacting to her kind of her and... like you said, the interaction between her and Joy, how Joy is trying to deal with the situation and put a positive foot forward.
Right. And the comedy comes from that character or several characters kind of not knowing what to do next, which is a good metaphor for who we are in this world. I mean, every moment we're faced with what do we do next? And most of us don't know what the heck we're going to do next and are confused and scared. And we put a good face forward and comedy says, it's okay. None of us know what to do next.
I was reading your book and shortly thereafter...
And what's the name of that book again?
You tell me, sir.
It's The Hidden Tools of Comedy. Where can you get it?
All the great bookstores, I'm sure.
Right on Amazon.
There you go.
And it's also available as a Kindle.
Okay, yes. Nicely done, sir. So I was reading that, and I then came across Mike Biblia's tour film, comedic show that they recorded called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. And it just seemed like he touched all of the points that you mentioned. And I mean, even from the very beginning, he talks about how he's an ordinary guy. He's got this ordinary outfit on. And then he goes into his routine about how he is, he doesn't have a lot of the skills, but he's still going after this girl. And yet he's still trying to stay hopeful all the way through.
I haven't seen that film, but he stole that from me.
Maybe. Okay. So he stole it.
He'll hear from my lawyers very soon.
Or I was wondering if he was actually a student of yours, because it just seemed like he hit those points, and maybe just because it was front and center in my mind, but it was one that his whole piece, it's on Netflix. It's called Mike Birbiglia's My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. But it just seems like it illustrates the things you talk about so well. Maybe he picked up the book of yours. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Stranger Things.
Or he owes you a check. He's like, I'll be waiting.
I always encourage people to steal. So maybe he stole from me.
Okay.
Or maybe I stole from him, but I don't think so. Because
to extend that, you're a teacher and you get to see your students mature and develop. What's an example of someone or something you see and you're like, all right, this guy got it. I'm hopeful. I am triumphing. You know, this is a win here.
Steve Strovan becoming an executive producer of Everybody Loves Raymond. Will Sheffer.
He was your guy. They started with your book or training or what?
He took classes with me and he was in my theater at Manhattan Punchline. Will Sheffer, who we featured at the HBO New Writers when I was doing that project for HBO, and him going on to do Big Love and Getting On. So, I mean, just There have been a lot of people who have gone on. I like what Steve said when I asked him for a quote on the book. He said, "I learned some of the most important things about writing comedy from Steve Kaplan. Only I'll never give him credit." So that's what I like, them just succeeding.
I see that. You make these big bucks. I got a quote. Thank you for that.
Exactly.
God bless you, sir. All right. This is the question I ask everyone at the end here.
I'm a Libra. My favorite color is blue. I like long walk. Oh, is that not the question?
Well, I mean, that was going to be for later when, you know, so the getting to know you after hours. But yeah, so let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
Oh, well, they can either get me live in a workshop. We're doing a workshop in Los Angeles January 28th, 29th, and all the information's on our website, which is Kaplan with a K, Kaplan Comedy, comedy with a C, kaplancomedy.com. We don't spell comedy with a K because even though that's funny to some people, that's not how we roll here. Homie, don't play that. I'm doing workshops in Los Angeles in January, Denver and Chicago in March, Tel Aviv in late March, London in April, and Munich in May. And you can find all that information on the website, read the book, or they can contact me directly, steve@kaplancomedy.com. We do consulting and working with writers and producers.
All right, great. Yeah, and it sounds like the show is just a few days away, the workshop in California. That's one of your big ones. The California one, right?
Right. I'm based here, so yeah. So
and you get to connect with other people in the industry in a industry hotbed town. So there's that. It's
exactly. Yes, you know, so I think that everybody who's in Baton Rouge, for instance, should fly out to Los Angeles and come to see the workshop.
Well, do you want to give our listeners a special discount from this area or just any kind people who hear this Encevides podcast?
If you email me with Encevides in the subject line, I will send you a discount code.
Oh, there you go. That's very nice of you.
I think it's $75 off.
Oh, see, that could be pretty huge, people.
Okay. There you go.
All right. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Nick, thank you.
All right. And that's my interview with Steve Kaplan. Just a few thoughts about the interview and some related topics. I connected to Steve's definition of comedy, the way he spells it out here in the interview and more extensively in his book. It's quite a helpful way to think about it. And even in the way that I've been trying to evaluate literature, is this comedy? Is this tragedy? It's useful to have some kind of framework to do that. A lot of the dramas, stories I connect to have elements of comedy and tragedy in them. Even in Shakespeare, in his tragedies, King Lear, Macbeth, some of the others, you see comedic characters, comedic moments. It's a big part of the human experience. We touched briefly on Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan film. Casey Affleck recently won a Golden Globe for that film. Well deserved. But the film didn't get all the awards that people thought it would get. La La Land got more for screenplay and so on. So maybe if Kenneth Lonergan had included a little bit more humor in that one, maybe might have done better. La La Land had, I don't know if you would say outright comedy, but more optimistic moments, more hopeful moments. And remember, Steve was saying that comedy is essentially a hopeful genre, that there's something hopeful about it, or the character trying to achieve something impossible, but still giving it his best shot. When the climate gets a little darker in the world at large, it seems like comedies do well. Look at the prominent films during the Great Depression. A lot of the screwball comedies, romantic comedies were doing fairly well during that time. Something to consider.
Speaking of Golden Globes, we learned from Meryl Streep that celebrities are, in fact, the most vilified people in the United States, possibly even the world. And so I'd like to take a moment to share a special public service announcement. It's an important issue that we need to address here on the Encevides podcast. Somewhere, a celebrity you know and love is shivering. Shivering from having to wear last year's fashion items. The humiliation, the anguish that comes from not being able to afford this year's fashion accessories. The expensive suits and dresses from Tom Ford and Versace, so many others. These celebrities cannot afford these crucial fashion items because of complicated tax structures in places like the Cayman Islands and other exotic places that you'll never visit. But that's not the issue here. Friends, citizens, patrons of the arts, I ask you, do you know the anguish you feel when you work diligently on a project for 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, and get paid a paltry $17 million for your work? And then you face the devastation of seeing the commoners on the street who greet you with things like, "You suck. I saw your movie, and I only gave it 1.5 stars because you didn't make me laugh even once." I don't know what that's like either, but I imagine it's painful having to see yourself show up in People magazine near the front, but not on the cover. Having your outfit rated a D-minus for all the world to see. These are painful things. This vilification is a worldwide epidemic that these brave men and women, our celebrities, have to endure. Let's help them survive this difficult season. If you and a few of your closest friends can make a monthly donation of $15,000 for the next 6 to 8 months, these celebrities in need will find the resources to regain their dignity, to walk in public in contemporary fashion attire. On behalf of celebrities across the globe, I thank you and your closest friends for your kind generosity. Well, it's all about giving back here on the Encevides podcast, but I did connect with Steve's notion that comedy is inherently truthful. There's the comic premise, the thing that is going to be the one false thing about the story or the setup, and then it's about being honest to the character, to the scenario, whatever it may be. And that's something that got me thinking, is comedy more honest than drama? Well, sometimes with comedy, you have people who say things that are actually astute social criticisms, things that maybe they wouldn't say normally. You see it in a lot of these comedians. They're actually taking on tough social issues and actually sometimes more insightful than people who aren't comedians. I mean, for a while, a lot of people were getting their news from someone like Jon Stewart. It wasn't just amusing. I mean, there was some truth to it. Maybe truth with an ideological bent, but still. So there's that side of it. Sometimes they take on those issues in comedy that they wouldn't elsewhere. But then again, you have the other side. When I was younger in school, I was the kid that would joke around sometimes, make jokes cut up in the back of the class or at church. Part of that was I wanted attention, but it was probably a little easier for me to joke around than to say, oh man, I hope they don't pick on me this year like they did in the past, or I wish I was better at fitting in, or I'm not sure if anyone here really cares about me. And I wasn't really able to communicate those things, so I made a joke. We have that. That's a part of who we are. You see it in human society. People put on the front, look good. How are you doing? Oh, I'm great, great. Yeah, did you hear about the one about the priest and the rabbi? And it's fun to joke around, but sometimes we do that because we can't say, you know what? My son, my daughter is dying, and I don't know how to pay for their medical bills. I didn't get the client. I'm afraid I might lose my job. I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't go to sleep at night. So instead of that, we tell a joke. This is the first podcast I'm recording after the Giants lost the playoff game. So my worldview is a little askew, as irrational as that sounds. It's not like I am connected to them. Well, I don't know, but there's that sense, oh, the team might do well. Who knows? Even though it's like, well, it could complicate things, as I explained in the past, and maybe it would be better if they didn't. But you still kind of hope, and it doesn't work out. So something that had been kind of a big picture thing, a big possibility, ongoing strange set of circumstances, somehow strangely symbolized by the rise and fall of the Giants. Is that a strange thing to believe? Sure. But I don't make fun of you for your security blanket or the way you talk to your dog like, oh, my little poochie pooch. Okay, so let me have my thing. I mean, I'm trying here. I'm doing public service announcements for these celebrities in need. So it counts for something, right? Throw me a bone here, okay? Well, anyway, the Giants are out of the playoffs, and now, at least in the next few weeks, as I'm mourning the loss, I will be quite tempted to believe that all that is good and beautiful in the world has been crushed by the evil forces of this ugly, ugly world. Or, as George R.R. Martin once said in regards to the loss of the Giants, life is miserable and full of pain. With this latest Giant loss, I don't see how this ongoing thing, the strange series of circumstances, gets resolved in a positive way. As if that weren't enough, the number 23's had a certain, I don't know, ongoing appearance in my life and in this podcast in particular. And it seems at a time like it's a hopeful number. It's leading to something. And then the Giants lose the game. The pass, that last pass that Eli threw, gets intercepted by Demarius Randall, number 23 on Green Bay, essentially ending the game, which had ended a while ago, in all honesty. But I mean, that was the final thing where it's like, they're done. That's it. So somehow appropriate for the way the number 23 has appeared elsewhere. It seems like a promising possibility, only to turn ugly and treacherous again. Well, all right. Looking back on it, though, was I acting in a way that I was doing whatever I could to try to make it happen, to believe that it would happen, or was I hedging my bets, being less than ideal? Well, I guess the latter. But part of that was I had stopped believing a little bit in my Dulcinea. More on that in a bit. But on the plus side, though, it wasn't enough to get me to start drinking again. I had said last episode that I've made a commitment not to drink for the next few months until around June. And the loss, as disheartening as it was not strong enough to make me start drinking again. So take that, number 23. What does it all mean? I don't know. Does it lead to anything? I'm not sure. Maybe it doesn't. A lot of things in our lives, we want to figure out, why did this thing happen? Is there a reason? There must be a reason. Maybe there's not. But we are drawn to trying to make sense of the chaos. We try to instill that in our art, in the stories we tell, to find some kind of hope. These days, if I look to some kind of work of art to say, what is closest to my worldview? I don't know, maybe Catch-22, where it seems like the whole world is insane, run by egos and bureaucracies and madness. And what can you do? Just kind of, I don't know, get some distance from it and find something to be amused about. I guess that's kind of hopeful to say, well, it's insane, but at least we can laugh about it, right? I wish that there was more resolution. I don't see it. Sometimes goodness doesn't seem to prevail. Things don't work out the way we want them to, and so we tell these stories. But I do get intrigued by the stories that have a mix of comedy and tragedy, right? You see it even in Inside Out. Joy is trying to get rid of sadness. She keeps coming back, trying to find her way back into the story. And there's this fascinating dynamic of how that goes back and forth. But you have that, and you have the comedy as well. Woody Allen does that a lot, playing on, is this a comedy or a tragedy, the human condition? Who knows? But here's a witty line that you might enjoy. One of my recent favorites is Stranger Than Fiction, and you have Will Ferrell's character going around with his little notebook trying to figure out, is this a comedy or a tragedy? And, well, I don't know. Lately, I've been seeing signs maybe it's a tragedy. Who knows? Who knows? Let's hope it's not. But the definition that Steve has about what comedy entails, it's worth considering. Once again, he says, comedy is an ordinary guy or gal struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. And so for some of these stories that could go both ways, it's interesting to apply that as kind of the touchstone to see which way does it lean. You have a story like Don Quixote, right? Where does that fall in? It's kind of gray area. I mean, he is ordinary guy. He's insurmountable odds, fighting windmills. And you don't know. In the book, are we laughing at this guy? Do we feel sad for him? What a tragedy. He's wasted his life fighting windmills. He read all those books about chivalry, and he was fool enough to believe him, that chum. Critics have struggled with how to interpret that book for years. Still do. But if you look at the musical version of it, that one leans a little bit more towards comedy. Man of La Mancha, right? And that one, there's some little changes. You still have Don Quixote thinking himself to be a great knight. And he still idolizes this girl, Aldonza, whom he calls Dulcinea, fair lady, worthy of chivalric tales. In Man of La Mancha, Aldonza is actually a whore, and the men who pay for her services mock her because Don Quixote sees her as Dulcinea. And yet, Man of La Mancha, she becomes persuaded by Don Quixote, by the ideal, the impossible dream that he chases. And she eventually strives to become Dulcinea. Don Quixote might be the consummate ordinary guy fighting insurmountable odds. It's not just a physical presence, it's a whole worldview. He's trying to keep alive this sense of idealism that the world just wants to shut down. And yet Don Quixote doesn't give up fighting, and Aldonza sees that. and wonders why. She sees that he doesn't give up on his ideals. He fights for them. He fights for what seems to be a better vision. The world isn't like that, but what if it were? She sees that, and it changes her a little bit. Now, critics will say Don Quixote, the book, is the superior form of art. It's certainly the more realistic. I am not so sure. Man of La Mancha is the more hopeful story, the one that had more impact on me. I saw a performance of Man of La Mancha and saw how the ideals of Don Quixote affected Aldonza. And I didn't think, what an idiot for believing in those stupid stories. But I thought, wow, that's what can happen when someone chases the impossible dream. Would be kind of great to be a part of that somehow. And maybe that's what comedy can do for us. We see it, we laugh, we say, that's impossible, that can't happen. But maybe a little bit of it changes us to say, well, what if it could be? Why not fight for that better world, even if it seems so far away? Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is a podcast on comedy, so I have to leave you with a little bit of hope, even though the Giants are out of the playoffs. And so, to mix our musical metaphors here, I'm going to leave you with a line from La La Land. Here's to the ones who dream, foolish as they may seem. All right, that's our show. What do you think of Steve's take on comedy? Do you connect to it? Do you have your own interpretation? I would really like to hear about it. If you want to share, you can leave a comment on the page or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. Don't forget that you can sign up for Steve's comedy workshop. There's one coming up January 28th and 29th in Los Angeles. And as you heard, Steve generously offered a notable discount just for being a listener on this show. Shoot him an email with the subject line, the Ncivitis podcast, and get that discount. And his email is steve@kaplancomedy.com. We'll include that in the show notes just to make it easy for you. If you happen to go, I'd be curious to hear how it goes for you and any new routine you want to share that grows out of the show. Music for the show, beginning and the end here, provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. You want to help this show lean a little more towards comedy than tragedy? Well, how about you share this episode, sing its praises to your friends, and leave a nice comment on iTunes. Then that might inspire me and so many others to fight for better things instead of reveling in the doom and despair of a bleak Manchester by the Sea exist. Okay. All right. Golden Globe winning. Anyway, it's the dilemma, the comedy or the tragedy of our existence. Who knows, ladies and gentlemen? Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations. And you look so sharp and distinguished. It's a tragedy that people will not...
Exactly.
It's a comedy podcast, but it's a tragedy they can't see how sharp you look. So
exactly. But now I can actually put my my screen back to regular brightness. Otherwise, I can't see.
Right. Well, the good thing is you could take a selfie of yourself and share it with me, and then that could be proof. Right. So you have a legitimate excuse to take a selfie and use it in this show if you want to seize this opportunity.
No, I think I'll pass.